from me. My name is David Mitrick, in case you've already forgotten. I was here 3 weeks ago. I gave a talk. On that occasion, when I was standing in for somebody else, and guess what? That's what I'm doing this evening. And the universe—I mean, the universal standing. I don't know. Why not universal? Let's have a bit of cosmic element to this. Yes, I'm unusual standing. I'm quite happy to give talks more or less at the drop of a hat, partly because I have spent quite a bit of time in India. I met Bharat there a few times in Pune and in Nagpur, and sometimes you give them very, very short notice to give talks in India, and sometimes they say, well, you've got to speak for at least 2 hours, that sort of thing, and you never agreed to give the talk in the first place. I think the last time I was in Nagpur, which is what, a couple of years back, the big preparation is being made for me to give a big full moon night puja at Nagaloka in Nagpur. And I hadn't a clue that I was a speaker. I was just going, who's the speaker? Nobody said anything to me until I was about to speak half an hour beforehand. But in London, we get much, much longer warning than that. I mean, I've had a whole 48 hours to sort of think about this, which is an absolute luxury, actually, when you think about it. So anyway, I'm particularly happy to see Bharat here this evening, all the way from India. And also Sanganath, but who lives in Cambridge. You're kind of English now, really, aren't you? Okay, so... kind of. It's my duty this evening to introduce you to Vajrasattva. Again, kind of coincidentally, the figure I spoke about, when was it? 3 weeks ago tonight, was Vajrapani. So they've got an element in common. Vajrapani, Vajrasattva. They both have Vajra-like qualities. But they represent quite different aspects of whatever the Vajra represents in a way. So I'll come on to that in a minute. But before I introduce you properly to Vajrasattva and describe the figure who you'll see seated on the moon mat on top above this lotus, that's Vajrasattva, an image of Vajrasattva. We've got postcards of Vajrasattva, which you can buy outside afterwards if you wish. But we'll have a look at that in a minute. I like to try and somehow make a personal connection with the topic that I'm about to speak about. And I do this evening have quite a strong personal connection with Vajrasattva. And it happened like this. Way back in January 1974, I was ordained into what was then known as the Western Buddhist Order. And I was 25 years old. And I'd only been involved in this movement for 18 months. Had I known then what implications this would have for my life, I doubt I would ever have gone through with the act. However, I did, and I'm still here. So something must have worked. And so my ordination took place over a space of about 12 hours. Normally people go away nowadays many people go away for 4 months on an ordination course. They're ordained in the course of that four-month period. It used to be towards the end of that period, but now it's increasingly towards the beginning. However, I was ordained on Friday evening, I think about 9 o'clock in the evening. This is my private ordination. I'll say what a private ordination is in a moment. And I was told that I must be there at least by 3 o'clock in the afternoon to prepare myself. So that was the amount of preparation that we used to have in those days, not very much. And especially when you consider, I really did not know what on earth I was doing. I'd asked for ordination because it seemed like, you know, what everybody else was doing. And I was 25 and, you know, it was hippie time and all that sort of thing way back in 74. Not that I was a hippie. I wasn't. I was a professional. It was the others that were hippies, not me. Anyway, we won't go into that. But what then happened? What did happen next? So, yes. So I had my private ordination. Let me say a bit more about that. So our ordination into the Sri Ratna Buddhist Order is, if you like, it has two parts, what we call a private ordination and the public ordination. So in the private ordination, you are you are ordained by your preceptor, your personal preceptor, who in a way just witnesses between, he's the sole witness of you going for refuge, making your commitment to the Buddhist ideals. In essence, that's what it is. The following, the next ordination, the public ordination, well, that's more like an acceptance into what we call our spiritual community. The Triratna Buddhist Order is a spiritual community. So usually there's a large gathering of order members, or at least a large gathering with quite a few order members present, to welcome you into our spiritual community, into the Triratna Buddhist Order. So, first of all, you have to undergo your private ordination. So what happened to me was this. It took place in Purley, which is just south of Croydon, and in a large kind of family house, a very large family house. And I had to go right to the very top of this house, where a small kind of box room really had been converted into a temporary shrine room. And in this room, well, yes, there was a shrine, and there was Sangharakshita, the founder of the Triratna Buddhist Order, sitting, waiting for me. I was one of five people to be ordained privately that evening. I think I was the third out of the five of us. And I had to go in, bow at the shrine, and make three offerings. But the moment I stepped into that room, I got the giggles. Don't ask me why, I just did. I got the giggles, irrepressible, unstoppable, ongoing giggles. And I giggled my way throughout my entire ordination. Sangharakshita must have been used to this sort of thing. He just sat there very, very kindly, very patiently, smiling all the way through, while I had this giggling bit. It's coming on now, recollecting it. But that's what happened to me. But a very important part of this ordination, it's not just that I had to commit myself to the three jewels. I was going to be initiated into a Buddha or Bodhisattva figure on whom I was then going to spend the rest of my life meditating. And again, I had not a clue who this figure would be. Most people, or many people at least, would go into that ordination, knowing, well, I want Manjushri, or I want Avalokiteshvara, Padmasambhava. I hadn't a clue. These are some of the other figures that we meditate upon. So I didn't know what to do. So when the relevant moment came, Sangharakshita asked me, well, which have you decided which Buddha or Bodhisattva figure you'd like to meditate upon? I said, no. I said, I really don't know. But I'm happy to leave it to you. And so he was very happy with that. He said, okay. He thought for a moment, said, Vajrasattva. So that was my first introduction to Vajrasattva. So what then happened was he recited the mantra, and I recited it after him. And that more or less constituted the main part of my ordination. Or let's say, put it this way, my introduction to Vajrasattva, my introduction to the Buddha and Bodhisattva figure that I was going to meditate upon. Actually, not really for the rest of my life, but I was going to make some effort to do that. Now, key thing about this was that Vajrasattva is quite unusual amongst the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas insofar as he has a 108 syllable mantra, which is a very long mantra. And what is of particular note here is that in the middle of that mantra there is laughter. And I was already set up. Maybe that's why he gave him that practice today. You know, in the middle of the mantra, you have these five syllables: ha 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 ho. I could do that very easily, representing different aspects of wisdom. I believe I can't actually, strictly speaking, remember. Even though I'm supposed to be telling you about this evening. I've got plenty I can tell you. I can tell you about what Vajrasattva really signifies. So that was my private ordination. So that was my personal introduction with Vajrasattva, a figure, frankly, I knew nothing about until I received the mantra. And then, of course, I was given the meditation practice later on, and I did do it. I did the best of my ability. And that involved reciting this very long mantra inwardly whilst visualizing the figure. So this is why we take these figures. We try to visualize them. We try to see them in our mind's eye, at least, or at least feel that these figures are present. And the reason that we do this is that each of the figures that we're talking about in this series represent different aspects of enlightenment. And so as you allow your imagination to dwell upon these figures, hopefully what happens is that gradually, perhaps over a long period of time, a very long period of time, I've been doing this sort of thing for 40-odd years now, that what they represent begins to influence you, begins to sort of have its impact within your mind, let's say. So that's why we do these practices. It's one way of bringing us closer to whatever enlightenment is. So that's why we do this. So Vajrasattva is a very popular figure to meditate upon within our community. So maybe I better start saying a little bit directly about Vajrasattva, what he represents and so forth. So as you can see on the shrine, there's this small image. And he looks like pretty much any other Bodhisattva figure that you're likely to see. But all of the figures are distinctive. They all have distinctive qualities, and they're associated with particular colours, with particular ritual implements, and so forth. So if you see, and you probably can't see very clearly from the back there, but anyway, I can tell you, you can see he's holding up something with his right hand, and it's right close to his sort of like right close to his heart centre here. And that is the Vajra, and he is Vajrasattva. He is the being of the Vajra. A Vajra is a diamond thunderbolt, and it's symbolic of wisdom. So his name means Vajrasattva, the being of the Vajra, the adamantine being. In his other hand, you can't see it very clearly there, but in his left hand he's holding a bell, a Vajra bell, a bell with a Vajra handle. And this is symbolic of especially skillful means, but also compassion. So he is the embodiment of both wisdom and compassion. Actually, all Buddhas and Bodhisattvas embody these qualities. But you see that quite clearly with him. He's got both the Vajra, symbol of wisdom, and the bell, symbol of compassion. So he's a very, very important figure, actually, iconographically and within the developed Buddhist tradition. He's even sometimes called the primordial Buddha. I'm not quite sure I fully understand what that means, but it's almost like the Buddha that stands behind all other Buddhas in a certain sense. But what specifically he means, the specific sort of significance he has within our own spiritual community is that he is the Bodhisattva of purity, of adamantine purity. And so that's what I'm going to be largely talking about this evening. Not necessarily of the about purity in its highest, loftiest sense, but I want to talk about purity within what that might mean for us. Because the idea of purity is probably not one that appeals to you very much. I mean, maybe it does, but it's not as fashionable as it was, say, a century or two back in this country. The idea of purity is something that most people wouldn't really give very much thought to. It's not something that they want to necessarily achieve. It's not a goal that they would set themselves. But Vajrasattva represents purity. He represents purity at the highest level. A kind of transcendental purity. In other words, a purity which is beyond space and time. Because he is representing or signifying, symbolizing an aspect of enlightenment, he is beyond space and time, or he represents consciousness, whatever, beyond space and time. So the purity that is represented or signified symbolized by Vajrasattva, is not a purity that can ever be lost. It's beyond, it can't be lost. It's there. It's, if you like, eternally, he's an eternally pure being. So we, if we're trying to lead the Buddhist life, are slowly trying to move towards that purity. This is one way of looking at the Buddhist life. It's just one window into the process of the Buddhist life, if you like. So we're looking at the Buddhist path through a particular window. We're trying to see it from a particular perspective, or through a particular perspective this evening, with the help of this figure. So if you see from this card, when he's represented as a painting, as a tanka, he's white in colour. Vajrasattva's colour is white, which is quite appropriate if you think of purity. Purity, I think, very often is associated with the colour white. I wear this white kesa. That's partly, it's connected with this, because what I'm trying to do by committing myself to the Buddhist life is I'm trying to purify myself in a certain way. I'm trying to purify myself of unskillful mental states. That's essentially the purification that I'm engaging with, to overcome all mental states which are in any way a reflection of greed, hatred, or delusion. So that's the kind of purification process that we're trying to go through. So that's the kind of purity we're after. I think the problem with this word purity is that it... because of certainly for those of us who've been raised in Western culture, it has associations with perhaps conventional religiosity, which we may not wish to have. And I think that's probably one reason why, for some people, the idea of purity is, as it was for me, frankly, is not an appealing one. But we have to try to imagine this in a totally different way from all the religious associations that we might have it from our Western religious background or conditioning. So one way of looking at this is that the whole of the Buddhist life, even the whole of one's life, my life as a member of the Buddhist order, is a process of purification. Partly, as I say, represented by the white on my kesa. I'm trying to become more and more pure in a certain sense. When I was thinking a little bit about this earlier this afternoon, I recalled something that was said by Shelley, the English poet. It's not from one of his poems, it's from an essay. And he speaks of what he calls the world's slow stain. The world's slow stain. So what we're trying to do, if you like, is to remove the world's slow stain from our minds. Now, any kind of stain, as you may well know, is difficult to remove. Something is not just dirty. If something which is stained is not just dirty, it means that there's something, some foreign element, if you like, has penetrated deep into the fibre, say, of a cloth. And it's very, very difficult to remove that, usually. Certainly with some stains. They're very, very, they can be very, very persistent. So a stain is not an easy thing to remove. It's not an easy thing to slowly disperse, get rid of. So that's what a stain is. But this is, Shelley speaks of the world's slow stain. Slow. It affects you slowly, gradually, over a period of time. This is what life does to us. We may start out fairly innocent in our younger life, but slowly the world stains us. And the older we get, the deeper and more difficult to remove that stain becomes. Which is why it's good to start as young as you can. But you can start at any time. For the older ones amongst us this evening, myself included. So we've got quite a few stains to work through. But That's what the world does to us. In other words, we are very, very strongly influenced by the world, by the world in which we live. We're influenced by, whether we like it or not, it's something we can hardly resist. But at least if you have, some ideals to live by, you can try to move towards them and try to not allow the world's slow stain to sort of seep in, to seep into your mind, to seep into your consciousness. So what we're talking about when we're trying to lead a spiritual life, when we're talking about trying to purify ourselves, we're trying to not allow that stain to get any worse, and even better, we're trying to actually slowly get rid of it, so we're left pure and adamantine in the end, like Vajrasattva. So that's a sort of gives you some idea of what we're trying to look at this evening. The idea of purification, of course, is quite common to different traditions, and it was very much part of the Indian sort of religious life at the time of the Buddha. Let's say the conventional religious life. There's a small sutta, a discourse by the Buddha, or a story of the Buddha's early days when he's on his own somewhere, and that tells you it's quite early on in his mission, as it were. He sees, not far from the place where he gained enlightenment, a place called Gaya Head. And at this place, there are a number of, truth seekers, wanderers. They were trying to purify themselves by immersing themselves in the water. And this is particularly aesthetic because it was at the height of the winter season in India, and it would have been cold there. It would have been pretty cold. Maybe not quite as cold as it is here, but it would certainly been very cold, and the water would have been, of course, very, very cold too. So I don't know whether that added to their sense of what it might do to purify themselves, but nonetheless, that's what they were trying to do. They were trying to purify themselves through this kind of ascetic bathing. And the idea of ritual bathing is very much part of as I understand it anyway, Hindu Buddhist culture. Certainly for Orthodox caste Hindus, if they feel they've been polluted by anything, even by coming into contact with Dalit people, then they have to take a ritual bath, those who are strict. So this idea is very much part of the Indian religious tradition. So the Buddha sees these people, these men, mostly, in fact entirely I should think, bathing in this river, or wherever, what is it, a river, Gaya? There must be a river. Naranjara?
Ganga.
Ganga. Thank you. Okay. So there is a river there, also, somewhere nearby anyway. So they've been bathing in this river. And the Buddha sees this and he reflects upon it. And he reflects like this. He says, they who, if you like, embody truth and Dhamma, that's to say, the ultimate truth, they are pure. So it's obviously, he's almost saying, well, what a waste of time. You know, if you really want to purify yourself, you're going to have to do better than that. Jumping up and down in the water is not going to do very much. You might end up a bit cleaner, a bit less sweaty, but beyond that, it's not going to do very much at all. It's certainly not going to do much, if anything at all, to your mind. If you want to purify your mind, if you want to see the truth, if you want to gain enlightenment, well, something else is called for, a different kind of purification. So what also interests me about this saying of the Buddha is that he brings together two things, well, three things, essentially. Truth, Dhamma, and purity. And so these three things are linked in this statement. Truth, Dhamma, and purity. Truth, well, what is that? Well, let's come on to that in a moment. Dhamma is the ultimate reality. Dhamma is the truth, if you like, that the Buddha realized. That's probably what it means in this context. So if you have that, then you'll be pure. But if you have truth and Dhamma, you'll be pure. So what could the truth mean in this context? Again, within our present society, the whole concept of truth is problematic, as I understand it, because Buddhism would assert that there is such thing as, or Buddhists would assert there is something as objective truth. But that is no longer considered to be, it's not always acceptable, that idea nowadays. But nonetheless, this is the Buddhist position, that there is such a thing as objective truth, and it's important to see and understand what that is. What's truth in the context of this saying? I think it means it's to do with the Buddha's utterance, because he's talking about someone essentially who was enlightened. And the Buddha taught the way to enlightenment. So it's a reference to the Buddha's utterance, if you like, the Buddha's speech, you could say, truth. But it takes things even a stage further. The implications of this are quite interesting. Truth and Dhamma leads to purity, or an expression of purity. Elsewhere, the Buddha says, truth is the deathless word. It's a completely different text. Truth is the deathless word. Truth is the word which, in other words, is immortal, the speech which is immortal. What immortal speech is, I leave that with you to allow your imaginations to dwell on for the moment. He's saying that the truth is the deathless word. He's saying essentially that truth is the prerogative of the enlightened. If you want to know the truth, you have to gain enlightenment from the ultimate point of view. What that means for our expression of what we consider to be truth is that it's only we're giving expression simply to partial truths. In other words, the rest of us are lying, whether we like it or not. We're not really giving expression to the full truth. We can't do that because we're not enlightened. We can only give expression at best to partial truths. So that's a big distinction between the enlightened speech and the speech of you and I, the unenlightened. No doubt there are degrees of that. But truth and... you have this connection between truth and Dhamma. But you also have this connection between truth and purity. And when I was thinking about this, something came to my mind. I'd seen a film recently by a young American woman documentary filmmaker. And she was trying to find out the truth about something. She was investigating the truth of a particular matter. And the whole of her film is about that. It's about the process of her in search of a truth. Now, it's not anything as exalted as the ultimate truth, the way things are ultimately in reality. But it was nonetheless, she was quite determined to get at the truth. You could see in her documentary, because she features in it quite strongly, in a way it's her personal story, you could see that she really wanted to know the truth. But what also I noticed was that when she felt that she was coming into contact with it, her whole demeanour was different from when she felt that she was not coming into contact with it. There was a certain kind of receptivity, if you like, a certain kind of purity which really impressed me. But that purity seemed to me to come from the fact that she really wanted to know the truth. Not everybody in her film seemed to want that. So on a lower level, I felt there's a certain connection here between truth and purity, certainly as it occurred in that film, certainly with regards to her interactions with the people that she met. Anyway, maybe I shall stop there and see if you've got any questions. Gives you some idea of what we're trying to explore, but no, there's a lot more that we could dig out, and hopefully you've got some questions. Hopefully what I've said so far will have stimulated something. You might not like what I've said. You're perfectly welcome to challenge it. Maybe you don't find it appealing. Maybe you do.
Maybe what you're talking about, or maybe opening up so many questions in my mind, but what hits me most is that truth, for most of us, and particularly that type of truth, is terrifying in some ways.
What do you understand that kind of truth to be? What kind of truth am I hinting at when I talk about the ultimate truth?
Because it's maybe I should only speak for myself, obviously, but in a way, it's a world that's so unfamiliar in so many ways. In my experience, in all the things that I've done in my life, not many people live within that type of truthfulness.
Mm.
So, you know, and you adapt, don't you? You adapt yourself to correspond with other people's truths.
So the world's slow stain affects you, maybe?
Oh, yeah, definitely.
Oh, it does, okay.
Yeah, and world stain, because that's all of our stains, I suppose. But, you know, it's, in a way, in the back of your mind, the thought that comes to my mind is Pandora's box.
Mm-hmm.
You open it up and, well, you've got to be prepared for what falls out of it, really.
Mm-hmm.
And so for me, it's exciting, but frightening.
Okay. So by Pandora's box, do you mean reality or do you mean something the opposite?
Reality.
You do, okay.
I think reality.
Okay, so do you have any understanding of how that reality is spoken of in Buddhist tradition?
No. And I suppose that's my fear, is because I don't.
Okay, well let's just stay with that for a moment. First of all, the world in which we live is said to be characterized by three things: by impermanence, by insubstantiality, and by unsatisfactoriness or suffering, which are not very, I mean, that's putting it negatively. That's what we experience. We're in that kind of experience of the world. That characterizes the sort of experience that we have. But we have a go towards something which is beyond that. And that's partly what this figure, this is entirely what this figure represents, especially the qualities of wisdom and compassion, but also specifically in the case of Vajrasattva, of what we might call transcendental purity. So you have the contrast between our immediate experience, which will be characterized by those three things in varying degrees, and the ultimate reality that we try to work towards. So we slowly try to leave this kind of experience behind, and we try to do that by developing positive emotions, greater awareness, etc. And that's the process of purification. Yeah?
Would you say, and you might be able to talk from experience, you know, with a lot of practice behind you, that as you go down that path, getting closer, as one goes down the path, getting closer, it would feel kind of naturally, it would, whilst being unfamiliar, there'd be a sense of it making increasing more and more sense, and it wouldn't seem like you were going into some, it would feel very natural,
mm-hmm.
in a way.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know.
I think that's certainly been my experience.
Mm.
Having been practicing Buddhism now for for 45 years.
Mm.
What I'm trying to do has become clearer and clearer and clearer because I've stuck at it. As you may have gathered from my introductory little anecdote, I didn't have much of a clue when I started out. I had some vague sense that this was heading in a positive direction, but I could never have defined that for myself. But as the decades have passed, it gradually became clearer and clearer to me what it is that I'm trying to do. I think if you take up the practice of the Dharma, you really have to be quite patient. It's not something which is you're not going to come to realization overnight. It's a very, very long drawn out process, but a very, very rewarding one at the same time. Was that sort of answering your question or not?
Yeah, I think so. Because I thought that was a good point about it being unfamiliar, and you know, it's not a world we live in.
That's right.
Ultimate truth.
Yeah. Yeah.
And of course, I thought maybe, as you said, as you go find it's rewarding your mind and your body, you know that it's actually where you belong, ideally, in the world of ultimate truth. You know, that's kind of...
We have sort of the intuitions of something higher,
that's
don't
what
we?
I mean, yeah.
Although that something higher is very, very difficult to grasp or sort of define. But you somehow sense there is something there. It's just, it's very, very elusive. But what the Buddha did, if you like, he defined a very clear way of realizing that, moving towards that. That's what the Buddhist path is. And it's something that all of us can achieve. Perhaps not in one lifetime, but eventually it's possible. Yeah?
I think, sort of, to build on these points that we've had, that you were saying fear, or maybe uncertainty of the ultimate truth, and then you mentioned about the lifelong practice. I guess that's building, or giving you the integration and the you know, practicing the Dharma, being positive, having that there is going to help to sort of approach this overwhelming thing in a much more positive light. I mean, I've had experiences where I've sort of been, had glimpses maybe of this overwhelming, unknowable truth, but I wasn't integrated enough in my life and found them too overwhelming.
Well,
it is the unknown is scary, and sort of letting go of yourself. That is, it's pretty daunting. So
and
I think
that's
important,
right.
Important to, you know, practice generosity and things like that to sort of give you more of a better grounding to deal with these things.
Well, the necessary basis for that is positive emotion. Which is why we teach the Metta-Bhavana practice. One reason why I teach the Metta-Bhavana practice. It's one reason also why we try to encourage the development of generosity, because that too springs from positive emotion. We try to develop as many positive emotions as we can, because positive emotion is able to absorb this sort of experience. Yes.
Yeah, I've got a question. I'm finding it sounds quite exciting, or quite like alluring, but other times purity sounds really boring, or like, so you're talking about in terms of giving you things, like opening up truth, and it's like a gift. But most of the time my thought of purity is like giving loads of stuff up, or like...
I do understand. I mean, I had
at the same time, I find what you're talking about exciting, but then part of me is also like, but purity doesn't seem
to be. Well, of course, it depends how you define purity, doesn't it? And certainly when I was your age, Alex, I felt the same. You'd be relieved to hear. It was not an appealing virtue to me. Certainly rather ironic that I should have ended up with a practice which was to do with realizing transcendental purity. But it's not, for most people, it's not a very attractive idea because of associations that we have with that idea. And you mentioned the idea of giving things up and that sort of thing. If I think of purity, I don't think of, now certainly, I don't think of giving up anything. I've given up very little in the course of my life. Certain things have fallen away from you. You might find this hard to believe, but it's true. Certain things have fallen away from me because I've lost interest in them. And that's partly what happens in this process of purification. So it's better to think in terms of, you know, slowly leaving behind all manifestations within your own consciousness of greed, hatred and delusion, petty resentments, petty jealousies, greed for whatever. I won't mention what for, but you can. There are plenty of things that people are craving. that sort of thing, lessening all that. The things that pollute us, the things that make us impure, all have their origins in greed, hatred and delusion. So what you're purifying is those. You're getting rid of those. You're not necessarily giving anything up in a kind of willful, conventional religious way. I've never done that. Having said that, I haven't had a drop of alcohol for nearly 40 years. I never gave it up. I just lost interest in it. I just found that as I was having less and less alcohol, I noticed the effect it had on my body more and more, even in smaller and smaller amounts. I felt poisoned by it. And I didn't like it, so I stopped drinking. But I didn't consciously do so. I just kind of drifted out of it. I mean, maybe there are certain things I suppose I did give up, but it wasn't a big sacrifice like I gave up eating meat. But that wasn't problematic. I kind of liked the idea of being a vegetarian. It had a certain attraction for me. Don't sense much enthusiasm for purification or purity.
I can get a sense of the need for it to be in sort of a juxtaposition to reality, because reality as well is objective, isn't it?
Well, let's say reality in that context, then reality would represent impurity, wouldn't it? I mean, let's say mundane reality, because we must make a distinction between mundane reality and transcendental reality, if we're going to use those terms. So one represents the impurity that we've got to somehow resolve and rise beyond, and the other represents the transcendent purity, which actually will...
So what is transcendental reality?
Leaving behind greed, hatred and delusion. But it's not that you leave these things behind, there's nothing left. It's also a process of developing, especially wisdom and compassion, the two primary virtues of enlightenment. And that takes a long time. But we get there by degrees. We have to be patient. Patience is a positive emotion.
Yeah, in terms of... moving towards being more pure, because you're saying about it's not, your perspective is you shouldn't necessarily, you don't have to give things up. Is it more about meditating and practicing ethics, and then gradually you'll find, because at the moment there are some things that, like drinking for example,
yeah.
I just can't imagine not wanting to, but and I feel like...
Doesn't matter.
No, but if you keep doing it, then that's going to keep making you. You're not moving towards being pure. But if you don't give it up, you're saying that you don't have to necessarily give it up.
Well, I think that if you examine your own experience, as I did, you might find that you gradually find it less pleasant and more and more unpleasant. That was essentially what happened to me.
Okay.
I never consciously gave up drinking alcohol. But I mean, there was the fact that I had less and less money because I was working full time for this movement. So that would have been a factor too. I just didn't have the money to spend on alcohol. But actually, the real thing was I lost my taste for it. I did not enjoy the effect it had on my body. So, if you don't have that experience, why would you stop? You might want to stop because you think it's a good thing to do, but then that would be you'd be much less likely to succeed. But if you examine your experience and you're honest about your experience, you might think, I don't know, I want to continue with this. That's all that happened to me. I sort of gave it up, but actually I didn't really, not in the sense that people normally understand that sort of expression. So you can't imagine not wanting to drink now. Can you imagine that? Sorry?
I can imagine it, but yeah.
You can. Okay.
I don't want to stop drinking.
Well, you don't have to. You may never do.
Okay.
But then you might. You might surprise yourself. And if you continue to meditate and so forth, you just might think, I don't want to do this anymore. Because you become more aware of what's going on with your body. I mean, has anybody else had this experience? You have a little bit of alcohol, and afterwards you feel almost like you're poisoned by it.
Yeah,
some absolutely. Of you have, yeah?
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, I feel I'm kind of halfway between. I certainly come from a place where, you know, I've been very conditioned to a social scene where, you know, alcohol is very, not just common, but it's very central to kind of my social life. But yeah, I'm very much feeling like even one glass of something or a beer, and I can feel it. And I've moved, I totally, like literally in the last few years, I've gone from feeling like, I'd never. How can I engage without that in the normal way? Mm. It's a feeling like I'm just my interest is completely diminished massively.
Can I just say a little bit more?
Anything up,
yeah.
I mean, I can do it with that.
Good. Well, and it's clear that quite a few of you have. But what I think, trying to put it in a slightly different way, what happens is that there are certain things that you enjoy or that you think you enjoy. Because you find them pleasant, or you think you find them pleasant. And maybe you do, but as you become more aware of yourself, of your body even, you realise that, well, actually, within that pleasant experience, there are certain unpleasant elements. And you may think that you may come to the point where you finally realise, well, actually, the unpleasant elements predominate. I don't want to do this again. It's more like that. Could you imagine that?
Yeah, like there are obvious unpleasant elements.
I mean, when you get drunk and when you wake up with a hangover, it's not pleasant, is it?
No.
That's just the extreme example of it.
Yeah.
So if you can imagine for someone like me, even let's say, I don't know, do we have pints anymore? Is it all metric? It's so long since I've been in the pub. I don't know.
Yes,
200. If I had 200 mil of beer, I can't. I just shudder to think what it would do to me. I'd be flat on my back. But more than that, I mean, I would feel horrible shortly afterwards because, I mean, not that's a particularly pleasant experience either, but, you know, to be legless is not exactly fun as far as I can tell. But having witnessed quite a lot of legless people on the streets of various European cities, there is an after effect in your body. You feel poisoned by it. Why would you want to do that again? That's been my experience. Sorry, we're getting stuck on this. I mean, perhaps we shouldn't say this. Perhaps you should move on to another topic, but you get the idea.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Quickly say something. I also think it is, I mean, I've been practicing or trying to meditate for the last 6 months. I've been coming to this centre for roughly about 6 months. And one of the things that I've discovered is that through meditating, through, you know, by readings and coming to Dharma nights and learning a little bit about Buddhism, a big part of Buddhism is looking inward at yourself, who you are, what your place in this world is. And I think as you start to do that, and irrelevant, you become more comfortable with in yourself, you become more comfortable with the body that you've been given, and I think you're gentler on yourself as well, you're not so critical of yourself. So that need for that drug, to enjoy yourself, to do the various things that you do when you're intoxicated, becomes less and less. And that's what it's been for me.
Right.
Yeah,
that's great.
Yeah.
Yeah. But let's just bring in another element here, because I think that it's really good if you have that kind of experience, you become much, much more aware of yourself. You're working on yourself. You're, if you like, engaging in the process of purification. But there's another way of doing this as well. And that is by going out from yourself and acting out of the positive emotion that you've been developing in your meditation. I hope my Indian friends won't mind me saying this, but when I first started going to India, I really didn't like it. I didn't, because I was used to the comforts of my nice, soft Western lifestyle. Even though I didn't have an awful lot of money by most people's standards, I had a lot more money than Bharat and Sanghanath would have had back in India. And I had to endure, for me, conditions which weren't easy, but which were normal and even better than normal for Barrett and Sanganath, perhaps. But it helped, the fact that I was going out for myself in that way had a different kind of process of purification. It helped me to overcome my self-concern, my self-preoccupation. Not completely, of course. I'm still very self-preoccupied, but a little way. Well, not too much, but it helped enormously. I'm deeply, deeply grateful that I had that opportunity to spend so much time in India when I was, let's say, healthier. Hopefully, I'll get back there eventually. But that's just one example of going out to others, working in a centre like this, trying to communicate the Dharma. It's taking you out of yourself. It's helping you to think beyond yourself, and that also is a process of purification. Yeah.
Does fasting fit in here at all?
It might do. But why do you ask?
Well, because it crosses over dangerously with the abstention point, but it's also reminded. The thought was triggered when you were saying how putting yourself in a condition of some discomfort actually prompted you to get close. You felt like you got close.
Right. Well, I suppose I mentioned that more specifically because it's not just that it helped me to go beyond myself, but it actually helped others.
Mm.
Yeah, I mean, that was the main point I was trying to get across. I forgot to mention it, actually. But I was going to India not to overcome my self-preoccupation and so forth. I was going there with an objective purpose. I had to, I used to travel all around our centres, meeting up with mitras. And giving talks and that sort of thing. I was teaching over there, so I was helping them. It was a benefit to others. It wasn't just something that I was doing for me to overcome my own self concern. Although it had that effect. It's like a side effect, if you like, a positive side effect. I wasn't doing it for that purpose. I was doing it because I wanted to help my friends in India.
But the process of purification more generally in Buddhist terms and Vajrasattva is not necessarily linked to fasting as a...
I wouldn't make that connection myself. The Buddha didn't specifically insist on fasting. I mean, the bhikkhus were, certainly as the tradition developed, were asked, actually had to take a precept of not having food after midday. So that clearly restricted the amount of food, their food intake. And that rule is still observed in many Buddhist countries now, and even so, quite a lot of Buddhist monks manage to get three meals in during the course of the hours between dawn and midday. Some of them don't bother with it. In Vietnam, mind you, that's a Mahayana country. I remember when I was there, several years back now, we had the most fabulous food. I was staying in the temple, and I was the guest of a monk, and boy, he could put it away. He really liked his food. We had three very large meals every day. But we certainly ate after midday.